Are you looking to upgrade your game on and off the field? Triple Crown Jewelry makes the cleanest jewelry in the game so you can show your style. Their jewelry is made by athletes for athletes with durability and style in mind. They make the best-selling number pendants and chains that you're already seeing on the field. Whether your style is gold, matte black, or silver, Triple Crown Jewelry has what you need. Personally, I'm more about the silver, but Triple Crown is ready for whatever your style. The chains look great. They're durable with a shine that stands out. And when you put it on, it has a nice heft to it. You can feel the quality. Your number is yours. It's part of your identity, and Triple Crown knows that. They have numbers from 00 to 99 available, so you can show your number, your identity, on and off the field. Their jewelry will never turn your neck green or fade. They're tarnish-resistant and made to last. These aren't just accessories. They're a statement of your dedication and love for the game. And that shine is unmatched. And in addition to choosing between the three different finishes, you can also choose from a variety of chains, including rope, Franco, and Cuban chains. So try it yourself. If you're ready to elevate your drip on and off the field, get some new drip at triplecrownjewelry.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 25% off your first order site-wide with promo code BA2022. That's BA2022 at triplecrownjewelry.com. And by doing so, you're supporting our podcast. Orders are shipped the same or next business day from New Jersey, and orders over $50 get free shipping. Don't miss out on the opportunity to make a statement both on and off the field. Go to triplecrownjewelry.com and lead the league in drip.
Welcome to today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy. And later in the show, we will be joined by Alabama coach Brad Bohannon, who is here to help us preview the College World Series Finals, which begin this week on Monday. They run Monday through Wednesday on your ESPN family of networks, 7 o'clock Eastern. I believe it's ESPN 2 Monday and Wednesday, and ESPN on Tuesday. Throw a little wrench into that for you. But that's where you can find the games. It is Mississippi State and Vanderbilt. Those are the last two teams playing in Omaha for the national title. For Vanderbilt, the Commodores are trying to repeat as national champions. They won in 2019. Of course, 2020 was canceled. For Mississippi State, they are looking for not only their first baseball national title, but their first team sport national title in school history. So a lot on the line here. We've got a lot to get to. It's been a very eventful week in Omaha, beyond the fact that we are now down to the final two teams. We'll address the NC State situation, talk a little bit about some of the other teams that have been eliminated from the College World Series. And I imagine we are going to touch on Jay Johnson being hired as LSU's next head coach before this podcast wraps up here. So we've got a lot to get to today on the Baseball America College Podcast, which is presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national-database. All right, Joe, we're here. It's Sunday, the day before the finals. A lot of excitement about that. We're down to the final two or three games, depending on how long the series goes, of the 2021 college season. And it's been a long road to get here, but we have arrived at now the grandest stage of college baseball.
We have, and it has been a long road that got even longer as time has gone on. We'll touch on some of that here shortly. But yeah, I think now, having been here the full, what will end up being almost 2 weeks by the time we're done here, but have been here more than a week now, I have even a greater appreciation for what these teams and coaches go through to get to this point, because it's not just the baseball is really good. It's not just that every team you're going to play is really good. It's not just that you are dealing with the moment and the opponent and the ballpark and pressure and all of that kind of stuff. It's also just kind of a grind. You know, you're away from home. You know, if you made it to this point, you're away from home and away from the creature comforts and the routine of that for longer than you have been, you know, pretty much all season, with only really the, you know, maybe an early season road trip a non-conference road trip or something, or the conference tournament even really rivaling it. But this is different than that because you're in one place away from home. And so it's just kind of a physical and a mental grind. And, so it really does give me a little more appreciation for these teams that have gotten here, especially in the, both of these teams have dealt with some unique circumstances. Vanderbilt, of course, was right in the middle of the NC State situation. And so that's kind of a unique circumstance to have to deal with. And by the time you listen to this, I'll have a quick piece up from, a press conference with Tim Corbin and Vanderbilt players about kind of what it was like to deal with that and how they've dealt with that. And, the Mississippi State side, things were a little bit more routine from that standpoint, but, they were pushed by Texas, had to fight their way out of the bracket against Texas. And so they've also played a lot of close games. And so they've been really taxed mentally and emotionally and physically here as well. So you've got two teams that have really, been pushed in a lot of different ways to get to this point.
Yeah. So we've kind of talked around it a little bit here just in the opening. So let's just get the elephant in the room here. And that is NC State's removal from the College World Series that happened very early Saturday morning. If you weren't watching the end of Texas and Mississippi State through the multiple hour rain delay, late in that one, you were probably asleep when the decision was made to remove NC State from the College World Series. The day began, Friday that is, began with them, with State taking on Vanderbilt in a bracket final. NC State was 2-0. Vanderbilt was coming out of the loser's bracket, so they needed to beat the Wolfpack twice to advance to the finals. That game was delayed due to health and safety protocols, was what we were told. It's delayed about an hour. There's a lot of who knows what's going on. Ultimately, it was decided that the game would be played. NC State had 13 available players, 9 position players, 4 pitchers. This has been the figure that's been quoted an awful lot. But one of the pitchers wound up being a position player. So really, it was more like 10 position players and 3 pitchers. I don't actually know if Sam Heifel would have been able to get on the mound even. Maybe he had like a couple outs in him. But anyway, NC State plays with 13 players. Oh, they were down 4 regulars. The pitchers they want to use were not available. They made it a really good game against Kamar Rocker and Vanderbilt, but Vanderbilt won 3-1. After the game, still a lot of unknowns. Elliot Avent in his press conference said that he didn't really know what was going on, but that he hoped that more players would be made available for Saturday's game. And, then we moved on from that, because that was always that specter was always hanging in the background. But, then Texas and Mississippi State took the field, and NC State went off to do more testing to try and clear all the players that they needed to clear. Ultimately, that was not the case. They had more positives after the game, including some players who had been vaccinated. And then the decision was made to remove NC State from the College World Series. They are the 6th team in Division I sports to have had, COVID protocols in their season. They, however, they had made it further than any of the other teams. There were 3 in the men's hockey tournament, 1 in the women's volleyball tournament, and 1 in the men's basketball tournament, but none of them had reached, a Final Four of their sport. So it was really a stunning move. It was stunning that it was announced when it was announced, the way it was announced, just with a press release. They just threw it up on ESPN. They didn't, they did not bother holding it for the morning, for a press conference, for anything. They just did it in the dark of night, and NC State was out. And it was a very weird situation all around. And with that, Vanderbilt advances to the finals. You know, they, instead of playing a winner-take-all bracket final on Saturday afternoon against NC State, that has ramifications of its own, obviously, because Vanderbilt didn't have to play that game and therefore, you know, has a slightly better pitching situation as a result. But the big thing here is just that NC State's season came to a crushing end, that, you know, I mean, it's not going to be forgotten by anyone in college baseball anytime soon. And it's, you know, for a team that had done so much to get to this point, they played so well in the second half of the season. They went on the road to Ruston, won a regional, went on the road to Fayetteville, upset number one overall seed Arkansas, and then win their first two games in Omaha. You know, thoughts of national championships certainly are deservedly being entertained at that point. But it all came to a crashing end there on late Friday, early Saturday morning.
Yeah, and I shouldn't be surprised by this, but unfortunately, I've seen a lot in the aftermath, a lot of binary discussions about the situation. And it seems like there is a lot of taking up sides between, you know, this is an injustice for NC State, and, you know, a lot of anger. And I'm not saying the anger is not warranted. And then the other side being like, well, I don't feel sorry for him at all. If you're not vaccinated, then this is what you were risking. And, you know, the answer, I think as humans, we are capable of complex emotions. And I think this should be a moment where we use those and understand.
We should be anyway.
Right. And understand.
I don't know anymore if we are, but we should be.
Right. That's true. Recent evidence is really testing that theory that I have about complex emotions. But so I've seen a lot too much of that binary. We can be upset for the players. Like, you know, here shortly, you will hear Brad Bohannon talk about how he physically felt pain in some ways for these players and coaches. And I think Teddy and I speak for everyone who was there, that you can understand how painful that must have been for this group of players, whether you were vaccinated or not, whether you were playing or not, whatever. And at the same time, you can understand that, like, this is a risk they were taking. And, you know, they had players who were unvaccinated, and that is the risk they were taking. And there was some, you know, Boo Corrigan, their athletic director, came out and clarified a little that, you know, some players were interested in vaccination, but were putting it off because, you know, some of these vaccines have made people feel a little bit yucky in the day or two after they get it. And so worried about what that would do during the middle of the season, because vaccines really weren't available for young people of that age demographic until the season was underway. So they put it off. So, like, okay, there's also that. But so those two things can be true. We can hurt for these kids and these coaches, and we can also say that they were taking a little bit of a risk, and people will come back and say, well, some of the positives were vaccinated players. And that is true, but they were only tested because they had unvaccinated positives. Unvaccinated players test positive. That triggered further testing, which brought up the positives from the vaccinated players. And we could spend all day, and frustratingly, many people seem to have spent all day the last couple of days, really arguing about this online, about whether or not we should be testing the vaccinated players, because it's harder to transmit with the vaccine, having been vaccinated. And that is 100% true. But look, these are the rules. Like, that's all I can say, you know, like, and so again, I'm trying to be very empathetic, because I do get it. Like, it is frustrating. If I were a fan or a parent or one of the players or someone associated with the university, I would be hurt as well. And even just as an observer, I'm hurt, because I wanted to see NC State have a chance to do something that program has never done, right? But on the other hand, it happened. These were the rules. There's no conspiracy against NC State. This was just an unfortunate thing that happened to NC State while they were here. And so the anger is 100% warranted. The frustration is 100% warranted. But I think that anger and frustration is misplaced if you're looking for conspiracy theories, or if you're going to be mad at the NCAA. There's a lot of reasons to be mad at the NCAA. You can maybe take issue with how it was announced, all that kind of stuff. But these were the rules that were put in place. The teams understood them coming into the tournament. The idea that the NCAA should just start winging it once something happens and once you know what hits the fan, I think is just foolhardy. So I understand a lot of people are lashing out because they don't like what happened. And I get it, man. Like I do, I really do. I hope this doesn't sound flippant, but these were kind of the rules and this was the risk they were taking. And unfortunately it cropped up and got them at the absolute worst time.
This is also a team that had undergone a COVID pause in March. They had an ACC series against Duke canceled. I think that's an important part of the story. It is possible. We don't know that, you know, some of the unvaccinated players perhaps did not undergo vaccination because they had previously had it. It's possible that they, whatever, I don't know. Not really here to engage in speculation. They didn't get vaccinated. If they had been vaccinated, they would have been exempt from all kinds of routine testing and this wouldn't have happened and, you know, all the rest of it, whatever. I don't know. I don't have a whole lot of interesting thoughts about this. I think I'm still struggling to process this more than 24 hours on, more than however many hours on we are now. It's something that I thought we, naively thought we had moved past. College baseball had largely done a really good job of not having its season impacted by the pandemic. You know, every weekend, basically, for the first 3 months of the season, probably, there were games that were being canceled, series that were being canceled. But it was never more than here or there, certainly not after the first few weekends when those games were always the easiest to cancel. They were non-conference games and long trips and probably just a lot quicker on the trigger. And also, you know, as the vaccines became more available and overall trend lines started going the other way, and you saw less of an impact of the pandemic. And then for it to happen on the stage of the College World Series, I mean, we hadn't heard hardly anything about COVID throughout the NCAA tournament. And then all of a sudden, here it is, rearing its ugly head at the worst possible time. I mean, it always seems to do that over the last year, 15 months. You know, it just has a way of inserting itself. And unfortunately, this is the way it happened. And it's terrible for really everyone involved. I don't think it's good for anyone that this is what happened. So chalk that up with the rest of COVID for the last, you know, again, 15 months, like nothing positive, you know, just whole series of negatives there. And, you know, I hate that this is where we're at. And it feels like a whole bunch of ways it could have been avoidable. But it wasn't avoided. And that's, I guess that's where we're at now.
Yeah. I think that's really well said. And I think it's a, you know,
a good,
yeah, no, I think so, because, you know, I think that, I think that's exactly right. We naively, this specifically is what I'm referring to, is that we kind of got lulled to sleep. I feel like, you know, you and I think were uniquely aware of what was going on in college baseball with reference to COVID, because you and I were tracking the cancellations. And, you know, at one point I kind of thought about bringing it up on the podcast, but it's almost like one of those things where it just wasn't really pertinent, and B, like I almost didn't want to tempt fate, but I almost brought up one time, you know, we've been having to do that less and less as the season has gone on. You know, it had really turned into like here and there, and the cancellations almost sometimes seem more like, hey, better safe than sorry. Like, it's not really that big. You know, if they were postseason games, maybe things would have gone through or whatever. You know, a lot of them seem like they were cancellations less out of necessity and more out of just like, to use that overwrought phrase, abundance of caution type situations. So I think we really had kind of gotten lulled to sleep a little bit that we were going to get through this thing without any sort of issue. And, you know, just, this is like after just a brutal, you know, year and a half now, I guess, at this point of not quite, but, you know, 14 months or what have you of dealing with this. This is just like, hopefully this is the last gasp of it, but just one final big slap in the face from COVID to college baseball, which, you know, it has been just dealing with this since early in the 2020 calendar year. So not the time for it, but unfortunately just one more thing with COVID in college baseball in a year and a half of full of almost nothing but.
Yeah, I mean, nothing about it has been an imperfect season. We have an imperfect College World Series. That's just where we're at. Welcome to 2021, folks. That's I don't know how much more we can say other than it's just a bad situation all the way around, and really unfortunate that this is now what this College World Series is going to be probably most remembered for. I mean, we'll see how history judges it, but this is forever going to be a part of the narrative of this year. As it should be. Again, imperfect season, imperfect College World Series. Why not? You know, that's where we're at as a country, as a world right now. All right, with that, let's move on. Let's talk about the games that are actually going to be played this week, not the games that might have been or the games that were. Let's get to this finals matchup of Vanderbilt and Mississippi State. And to help us do that, we're going to bring in Alabama coach Brad Bohannon. The Tide played both the Commodores and the Bulldogs this season, so he's in a position to help us break down the situation there, the matchup there, but between these two teams that you'll see play out in Omaha this week. So we'll get to Coach Bohannon here in a second, but first, check this out. Today on the Baseball America College Podcast, we're excited to be joined by Alabama coach Brad Bohannon. Alabama played both Mississippi State and Vanderbilt this season, part of their exceedingly difficult SEC slate. So we wanted to get Bo on to talk about these teams and what the matchup this week is going to be like. So, Coach, we're happy that you were able to join us. Obviously, wish it was in slightly different circumstances for everyone, but happy to have you on to talk about this matchup.
Well, thanks, Teddy and Joe. Appreciate you having me. And, you know, that's a tough thing about sports in general. Typically, only one team gets to win their last game. So just huge congratulations to Mississippi State and Vanderbilt both for being here. Great teams, great programs, really well coached. And, you know, having played both clubs in May, I'm not surprised that they're the last two teams standing.
Yeah, not only did you play both of these teams, you played them both late. Mississippi State was the last weekend of the regular season. Vanderbilt was a couple weeks before that, both on the road as well. Again, just not an easy slate for the Tide this year. But what, starting with Mississippi State, I guess, what stood out to you when you saw them?
Well, I really think both teams are really complete, really well-rounded, and they're a little bit different, but you know, that both clubs, just like every team's, have strengths and weaknesses. And I think it always kind of starts on the mound. Both teams, Mississippi State has really good starting pitching and an absolute buzzsaw on the back end. And, you know, Vanderbilt, maybe their 1-2 punch with Rocker and Leiter are a little bit stiffer than Mississippi State's and not quite as deadly on the back end, but you know, both teams really, really pitch at a high level with their top five or six guys, and they're both really tough to score against.
You mentioned the 1-2 punch there of Rocker and Leiter, and we're not going to get to see it as a 1-2 classic punch, you know, just because of the way the schedule sets up, with Rocker having thrown on Friday. So the expectation is Leiter will pitch on Monday, and then Rocker would be available to go in game three. Does it matter that they're not seeing them back-to-back, or that they don't have them back-to-back?
I don't think so. You know, obviously the national championship is going to come down to who wins two out of the three games. And I would imagine that both coaches, that Lamb and Corbs, are going to tell their guys, hey, just worry about today and just play, try to win innings and just try to win pitches. And you can't get too consumed with, you know, the second game or the third game. And that's human nature, and that's the job of coaches. Hey, let us worry about, you know, making pitching decisions to cover, you know, the innings or the bullpen the next day. And the kids just need to worry about playing in the moment. So, you know, trying to evaluate the series and make a prediction and all of that, it is a little bit different with the lineup of the pitching and the uncertainty that, hey, you really can't leave any stone unturned, and you really can't save anything for tomorrow.
One of the things that's been talked about a decent amount this year with Vanderbilt was that, you know, you get past Rocker and Leiter, and not that that's the easy task, but you get to game three and Vanderbilt's a little more vulnerable, but it strikes me that that's relative, right? So you don't get to face Rocker and Leiter, but it's not like Vanderbilt runs out of arms after that. And so I'm curious if you could give voice a little bit to just what to expect with kind of the rest of the Vanderbilt staff, whether you're talking the bullpen guys, Murphy, Maldonado, you know, Christian Little, you know, McIlvain, like those are quality arms. And it feels to me like we've maybe gotten a little over our skis sometimes with making an assumption about, well, if you just get Vanderbilt to a third game, they're a little bit susceptible, because I mean, those guys have shown this week that they're really up to the task as well.
Yeah, that's a good point, Joe. I think sometimes when you have superstar players, they can overshadow, you know, some of the other guys that are really key pieces. And I mean, having Jack Leiter and Kumar Rocker is a 1-2 punch is special. That's something that happens, you know, once in a coaching career or every other year if you're Vanderbilt. But, you know, to have, you know, two guys of over 100 innings of, you know, a 2.5 or sub ERA that are strike throwers that pitch into the seventh inning, it seems like every time out, it is just really special. But, you know, even when they get to a game three, maybe they're a little more vulnerable on the front end of the game, you know, if they're starting Christian Little or Patrick Riley or whoever. But, you know, you mentioned some really good pieces, that Nick Maldonado is a really key piece in the bullpen, and Luke Murphy has thrown some really good innings, and McIlvain has really pitched well. And, you know, they're not chopped liver. You know, those are guys that have stuff and that throw strikes, and they have some experience. So just because it is maybe a little more manageable in a third game, is certainly not easy.
On the state side, Landon Sims is the guy that they're trying to get the ball to at the end. He's pitched in all three of Mississippi State's wins in Omaha. He's given up just one run in those games. No one has figured out how to beat him this year, obviously. But is there a plan of attack against him at all? Or is there just, you got to hunt the fastball?
Well, both of his two pitches are plus. I mean, he really pitches off of that high spin four seam fastball up in the zone, and he does a good job of throwing it up in the zone. Has a really good slider that seems to have a little different shape than maybe your typical slider, and he does a good job of throwing them both for a strike. So I think anytime there's a pitcher that's got a real out pitch, that you do want to be a little extra aggressive to the fastball. But you know, hitters, for whatever reason, they don't get to it, and they or they foul it off, and they're two plus pitches, and I'm not sure that you can really sit on either one. He's tough, and that's one of the reasons that he's had such so much success this year.
One of the other guys that's been big for them has been Bednar, and the way he's really kind of, especially in light of the fact that, you know, Christian McLeod, first time around, they didn't get as much from him as they would have liked. So getting what they've gotten from Bednar feels like maybe the most important thing that's happened for them on the mound in this College World Series. What were your impressions of seeing him, and what do you think has made him be able to turn it on late this season?
Yeah, we played Mississippi State. It was our last conference weekend, so we played him the third weekend in May, and Bednar was just electric against us, and he did a great job of really getting his fastball to glove side, and his slider just really tunnels well. It doesn't come up out of his hand, and our guys, even left-handed batters, were swinging at his breaking ball like they were seeing a fastball, and obviously it was not. So, you know, he's a guy that I think the back half of this year has, or the back third of the season, has really kind of caught his second wind and seems to be taking a step forward. I think his last, his two outings in Omaha may have been two of his better outings this year statistically. So, you know, and you're also talking about a guy who hasn't pitched a lot of college baseball. And to me, that's what makes Will Bednar and Jack Leiter so special. Or, you know, these guys didn't pitch last year, and this is their first time through the SEC, and they're doing this, and they're doing it, you know, at the 110 inning mark in June. And I think those two guys are really, really special.
Obviously, pitching has dominated this World Series to this point. I think both teams are hitting sub 220 to this point. And that says a lot about the level of pitching out here, but you do have to score runs to win. When we look at it, Mississippi State at the top of the order, Rowdy Jordan, Tanner Allen are the big guys. They're the veterans. They've been here before. What's it like starting a lineup, you know, facing those two guys?
Well, it's not very fun, I can tell you that. Those two guys, they're old, man. You know, they've been around the block, and, you know, Rowdy's a switch hitter, and Tanner Allen was the player of the year in our league. And They're just good, and they're older, and they know how to play baseball. They know how to have at bats, and they've been consistently good, and they're threats. And, you know, they've got some pieces in the middle that don't get as much attention. But, you know, guys like Logan Tanner and Cameron James and Luke Hancock, those guys are threats. You know, they're all double-digit home run guys. And, you know, to me, you know, they've got a little bit of length to their lineup. And just like most every team, there's some guys down at the bottom that don't particularly scare you. But, you know, the whole key to Mississippi State is getting those bottom guys out, because if you let those guys get on and then you got Tanner Allen and Rowdy Jordan up to bat with people on base, you got a problem there.
One of the things that we knew about this Mississippi State team coming into this College World Series is there kind of just seems to be something about it, whether the leadership they get from guys like Rowdy Jordan and Tanner Allen or whatever else. I mean, we saw it last night with a guy in Tanner Leggett getting a walk-off hit, a guy who came into the game in the seventh inning and doesn't have a ton of at-bats late in the season. And there he was. How is that kind of thing expressed, whether it's a team that you've coached before that just kind of has a little bit of magic to it, or from what you've observed? When we talk about teams that seem to come up in those big moments, how can you explain how that ends up getting expressed in the way the team plays and how things shake out?
Yeah, Joe, that's a great point. I think every coach would tell you that a lot of times, you know, the biggest pitch of the season or the biggest at-bat of a season, it seems like it's somebody that's down in the order, a part-time player got an opportunity because of injury. It doesn't seem like your best player, your three-hole hitter, is ever up to bat with a season on the line. And, you know, it's just a great lesson for us as coaches and the young players. We tell our guys all the time that, you know, hey, you got to be ready for your opportunity. And it's very humbling to be a coach at the college level, because you look at your lineup on opening day and the pitching roles, and then you look at it in May or June, and it's always different for all of us. And you just don't have a crystal ball, and you don't know how the season's going to evolve and who's going to grow and who's going to have a hard time handling failure and injuries and all of that. So it was really cool to see a guy come in as a defensive replacement and get a walk-off hit in the College World Series. It's pretty special and a great learning tool for all of us.
The other thing about this Mississippi State lineup is they just don't strike out much. That was about the only thing Kamar Rocker was willing to say to the media today when asked about the Mississippi State lineup. But it is a very notable thing that in a league where, you know, you see more of the trend like you see in pro ball, where home runs and strikeouts are king, Mississippi State is bucking that. I mean, if you look across the way at Vanderbilt, you'll see a lot higher strikeout total. So what does that then do when you try to attack them, that they're part of their whole mission is that they're up there trying to grind at bats and at least work pitchers' counts, if not, you know, find a way to bust a single through rather than, you know, maybe swinging a little looser, a little more for the fences?
You feel it when you're in the opposing dugout. You know, it's crazy that you got two of the best teams in college baseball, and there's 170 difference between the strikeouts of the two clubs. And, you know, Vanderbilt, obviously a very good offensive club, and 90 stolen bases, 89 home runs, just a lot of threats. But, you know, Mississippi State, you feel that they're going to put the ball in play. And we tell our kids all the time that, hey, if you just put the ball in play, you got a 30% chance of getting a hit or getting on base. And it's a lot easier said than done. So this is going to be the typical, you know, Vanderbilt power stuff, power arms that strike out a bunch of guys against a team that, at least by SEC standards, the toughest to strike out, and it's two heavyweights slugging it out.
I wanted to ask a little bit about some defensive considerations. Obviously, you know, you've not been in the position of had to consider this yet, but I'm curious, as you observe the College World Series or have talked to coaches who have had considerations like this, what do you think about defensively? I mean, a lot gets made about the fact that it's a big outfield. You know, you've got a lot of fly balls that just kind of die on the track. It's also this time of year where you see a decent amount of sack bunting and a lot of stuff like that. So putting yourself in those shoes, you know, if you're getting a team ready to play on this stage, in this ballpark, what kind of defensive considerations are you thinking about?
Well, I think you made a couple of good points. It's a big outfield with deep gaps. And, you know, I think these two teams, you get to this point of the year though, and you kind of have your guys that you're going with, and, you know, the SEC tournament's a good prep for this, because, you know, the Hoover Met has a really deep outfield with really deep gaps, and you need to be athletic out there. And you know, these games are going to be tight. I would be really surprised if at least two of these three games aren't tied in the seventh inning or one run games. And When you get in those situations, all the little things are amplified, and you got to be able to get a bunt down. You got to be able to defend the short game and maybe steal a base when the math of the leg time and the catcher's throw isn't very favorable. And, you know, so you're really going to have to execute the little things at a high level, and defense is just a part of that.
You mentioned speed and stealing bases, and obviously think of Enrique Bradfield when we think of that right now in college baseball. He hasn't really been a huge factor in terms of getting the running game going, and at least in stolen bases in Omaha. But what does he do to opposing pitchers when he gets on?
You know, Teddy, when we played Vanderbilt, I mean, in 18 years in the conference, I don't know if I've seen anything like Bradfield as far as the pressure that you feel when he gets on base. And, you know, we told our guys that, like, hey, just you got to focus on making the pitch. Like, we're not going to throw him out. You know, if he gets on, you can't get so consumed with it that you're picking three times and now you're missing your location because you're so worried about being too quick to the plate. And just a really, really electric, dynamic threat. And, you know, the whole key is keeping him off base. If he gets on base three or four times, he's going to score two or three times most likely. So I think that's big. You know, you got to do your part of trying to, you know, be quick to the plate, control the running game, but you can't be consumed with it. And if he gets on first base, there's a high probability that he's going to get to second, and you better make pitches and make him get a hit to score.
You know, at this stage, you know, these two coaching staffs have been here enough to kind of know, but from your perspective, how important is it when you're a team in this position to kind of end up staying true to who you are? Because I feel like it's a tempting thing to maybe try to do something a little extra special or really push the issue or, you know, try to maybe do something that the opposition wasn't necessarily prepared for. And while maybe you get away with that, it seems like just as often it could backfire and all of a sudden your team starts spinning its wheels a little bit. So take me through kind of the thought process of how you approach just basically dancing with the one who brought you and trying to win games the way you have all year at this point.
Yeah, I don't have any doubt that Lim and Coors both are telling their guys, hey, just go play. Don't try to add to anything. Just we're here because we're really good and we just need to be who we are. And, you know, it's easier said than done. Everybody knows what's at stake and we're all human. And, you know, I'm 46 years old and I'm sure if I was coaching in a national championship that I would be a little more anxious than normal and much less, you know, 19 years old. So that's something that all of us talk about. And, you know, I think no matter what you're playing for, when you do something for the first time, it's a little tougher, whether it's your first time in a regional or first time in a super or first time to Omaha. A lot of guys say sometimes you have to get to those places before you can actually win them. And, you know, you're talking about two teams that have a large part of the kids on the field have been in the College World Series before and even multiple times. So that's a pretty interesting dynamic. Usually you get teams in the national championship and maybe they haven't played in this environment or these stakes before. And even though Mississippi State's been to Omaha three times in a row, I don't know if being in the actual national championship series will be different for them. But, you know, the whole key is going to be just being who you are, not trying to add to anything and not letting the game speed up on you too much, even though, you know, everybody knows what's at stake.
They played a three-game series in late April, Vanderbilt won. It was in Nashville. Obviously, things have changed. The stakes are different, all the rest of that. But how do you try and lean into that? Do you try and use that as motivation on either side? Or do you think they try and just flush that and recognize that that was 2 months ago and you know, not try and use that at all this week?
I don't think that weekend will be a big deal. I mean, it's almost 2 months ago, and it was a very competitive series. I mean, you go on the road and lose two out of three to a top five team in the country. There's no shame in that. You know, so the games were tied. And these are two teams that are great teams that nobody is surprised that they're the last two standing. They're a little bit different, but, you know, this is a 50-50 series. So, yeah, I don't think something that happened 2 months ago where the home team won two out of three in some tight games is going to have any kind of impact. And it may even give all the kids on the field a little bit of peace of mind of just being familiar with your opponent. You know, that sometimes that can be a little comforting that you at least know exactly what you're going to see.
The last thing I got for you on this series is, you know these coaches well. Obviously, Tim Corbin's been around the SEC throughout the 21st century. You recruited against Chris Lemonis when he was at Louisville and you were at Kentucky. What have you picked up on watching those two guys and getting to know them, you know, across the diamond throughout the years?
You know, it's crazy about coaching of how you can be so different and still be successful. And I'll say this, I don't think Lem is any different. He's the same guy that, you know, when we're watching 15-year-old kids up in Wisconsin 15 years ago, you know, like now that he's the head coach at Mississippi State, even though I'm not at practice or I'm not inside their program, I don't think he's changed a bit. I think he's really stayed true to who he is and hasn't tried to be somebody else because he's in a different role. And, you know, Corbs, I mean, he's, you know, the gold standard in college baseball with what Vanderbilt has accomplished. And, you know, he's been there, he's done that, he's won national championships and you know, just tremendous respect for both of those guys and really happy for both of them. I think they are both classy individuals that have really strong work ethics and high character and do it the right way. And, you know, it'll be a lot of fun to follow the series and I'll be really happy for whoever wins it.
I'd be remiss if we didn't ask you a little bit about your own team. And, you know, in 2021, while I'm sure you felt like maybe you guys left a little bit on the table there to accomplish, it was still a return to the postseason for the program. And how did that feel? What was that like? How important is that in terms of now trying to build to something bigger moving forward?
Yeah, thank you, Joe. I was really proud of our kids this year. And, you know, I think the SEC West, you can argue, is the toughest division in all of amateur athletics. And it's a tough place to rebuild in. And, you know, we as coaches that are familiar with the internal parts of our program, we can see the progress before everybody outside can. And, you know, we were very fortunate to get into a regional by the skin of our teeth. And I think it was a great experience for our kids. And, you know, in the recruiting process, you talk about, hey, we can go to Omaha and Alabama because our school's been there five times before. And you know, kids, you know, once you get a little closer, it feels a little more tangible to them. So just really happy for our fans and appreciate them. They've been unbelievably patient and supportive. And, you know, I felt like we had a regional team last year and didn't get to prove that because of COVID and obviously got in this year. So I think everybody can truly see the tangible improvement of our program. And we started six freshmen or COVID freshmen in a year where college baseball was as old as it's ever been. So really proud of what we've accomplished to this point and really excited about the future of our team.
When you start to look at the 22 team, obviously a lot can still change. We're, as we sit here at the end of June, the draft still is a few weeks away. But what do you think about how the Tide set up for 22?
Well, I think we've got some really good pieces coming back. You know, like I mentioned, in a year where college baseball was really old, we had six freshmen or COVID freshmen in our starting nine. And those kids are good players. And I think any coach would tell you, you see the biggest jump from that first year to the second year. And, you know, we're not really sure that we had more than our share of injuries this year on the mound, but just to the wrong guys. And because of that, we pitched some guys and asked them to do some things that maybe they weren't quite prepared for, but you certainly would think that they would grow from that and be, you know, in a better position to be successful next year. And I think we've got probably the best recruiting class that we've ever signed coming in this fall. We may lose a guy or two to the draft, but, you know, we'll have the best collection of talent on next year's team that we've had since we've been here. And, you know, you can't just roll the balls out. We got to do a good job of coaching them and even grow the outstanding team culture and environment that we have. But I couldn't be more excited and bullish about our program than I am right now.
Last question to get you out of here on. I mean, obviously right now what everyone is looking at is the finals, but the story of the World Series in some ways has been what happened to NC State. Just when did you like see that news and how did you, you know, begin to try and process that from afar?
You know, I was out recruiting and was just watching games with other coaches and somebody saw it on their phone. And I literally like could feel it physically, like just the gut punch. Like I can't imagine the emotions that those players and those coaches and just everybody involved felt, because I felt it just from afar. And I just can't say enough about, you know, the season that they had. You know, obviously we got to play NC State in a regional, and you could just, you could feel it, whatever it is, you could feel it in the regional and the other dugout, that they were just kind of a team of destiny and really talented. And they had great players, and they were in a real position to win a national championship. So, you know, we'd just like to congratulate them on a great season and just unbelievably unfortunate. I don't even know what to say about it, Ted, except I'm so sorry to them and really happy for what they did accomplish, and just can't imagine what they're still feeling right now.
Yeah, it's just one of those situations. I don't think there is anything really that can be said. I've been at a loss for the last 2 days myself, so certainly understand that feeling there.
I was gonna call or text those, you know, Clint or Coach Hart or Elliot, and I didn't even know what to say. I don't think there is anything anybody can say or do, and just really, really unfortunate.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hopefully we get a great finals here. It's been overall, aside from the drama of that, it's been a great World Series. So hopefully we get three more good games. As much more college baseball as we can get here, and get out of here on a high note in this unprecedented 2021 season.
Absolutely, it'll be a great series to watch, and I think it'll be a lot of fun. It's been a great College World Series, very eventful, and some things we would like to forget, but you know, turn back the clock 12 months and I think we'd be really happy to be in this place.
That is 100% the truth. Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us here on the Baseball America College podcast.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Y'all have a great day and enjoy the rest of your time in Omaha.
All right. Thank you to Alabama coach Brad Bohannon for joining us today on the Baseball America College podcast. Joe, this promises to be a very exciting series. I think when we talk through it there, it's, you know, you just think about all the different matchups, how good these the games were when these two teams played earlier this year, the pitching that'll be on display, you know, the star power that this provides. I mean, this is this should be a fun matchup for college baseball to close the season on.
Yeah, as much as it might be nice sometimes to get a little variety, you know, get the cross regional matchup, you know, West Coast versus a team in the Southeast or what have you. This is a matchup that feels in a number of ways, I think, inevitable is maybe not the right word, but like, of course it's going to be these two teams, because, you know, maybe if you sub in Arkansas for Mississippi State or for Vanderbilt, maybe
you could be for Vanderbilt based on the bracket.
So like, yeah. So, I mean, maybe you know, sub that in and maybe it feels a little more as an encapsulation of 2021, but I will say what we lose in that, perhaps to the extent that you would consider that losing something, would be that, you know, Vanderbilt and Mississippi State have some history, and, you know, it got brought up a decent amount in the pre-championship series press conferences that we had on Sunday morning. And neither side was really super engaged on the topic, but there's no denying that like these two programs have just butted heads time and again in recent years. And so it I guess in that respect, it is kind of, again, struggling for the right word, but somewhat inevitable or fitting perhaps that it's these two teams coming up at the end.
Tim Corbin in the press conference said that I loved him going with the very philosophical, well, what is a rivalry? I don't know if that's how he meant, but how I'm going to choose to take it.
Yeah, he was really willing. He made it sound like he really wanted to deconstruct what we referred to as a rivalry, which, hey, I'm here for. Like, I'm the guy who has mentioned on a couple of occasions that I think it's dumb that one of the like really widely accepted definitions of a rivalry is that both teams have to win with regularity. And like, I just vehemently disagree with that. And so like, if he really wants to spend some time, like truly taking apart the idea of a rivalry, like he should give us a call, because I think we're ready to have that discussion.
So this is not a traditional rivalry. This is not a cross sports rivalry. This is just a straight up, like, these two fan bases don't like each other. The teams have played some really meaningful games. In 2018, Mississippi State beat Vanderbilt in a super regional to get to Omaha. It's just, it's it's just one of opportunity. And, you know, maybe now that they're playing in a CWS finals, this will like have some serious staying power. Cause I think that no matter what happens this week, there's going to be like, this is going to be something that's going to get thrown around an awful lot between the fan bases. So we may be watching a new rivalry, like really come into its own before our eyes this week. So that's exciting, I guess. I don't know. It'll be interesting to watch. I think the point that I wanted to make before you recalled the my mind the comment that Corbin made today was okay. So this is an all SEC final. This is the second time this has happened in five College World Series, 4 5 years, whatever. 2017 was the last time it happened. They get confused since they canceled one. Florida and LSU that year, I think it's the fourth time overall in College World Series history that the finals has been a conference showdown. Obviously, the SEC, like we talk about it all the time, as the best baseball conference. But is this like actually like, I don't know, Joe, what are your feelings on another all SEC final? In Omaha.
I mean, so on one hand, I think it is a representation of where the sport was this year. I mean, as kind of interesting as it would be for us to bang on the ACC, and for a while it looked like maybe NC State and or Virginia was going to be in this position. So, you know, that was kind of an interesting potential subplot, but I think it is a pretty good representation of what the sport looked like in 2021 and increasingly looks like year after year. So I'm not going to bang it from that standpoint. Personal preference, though, would be a fresher matchup, if I'm being honest. Like, as interesting as I think it will be when rubber meets the road in this series, you know, just for my personal aesthetic, I would like a matchup that's a little bit fresh that we could kind of like dive into and speculate about that we haven't seen on the field, which is not to say it's going to go like it did last time, but, you know, we've seen this matchup. And so something a little fresher would not have hurt my feelings, I'll put it that way.
So I don't really care about that standpoint of it. But it does somewhat concern me that no one is, it just seems increasingly, the SEC has put at least one team in the finals for like, I don't know, 12 years now. I'd have to look at it again, but it's a long time, except for 2016. And it just, all credit to the conference and to the schools for working as hard as they do. Like, they are what is driving the sport right now. But at some point, for the health of the sport, like, somebody's got to step up. And I know the ACC at times has seemed like it was getting close to that. But at other times, it seems like the ACC is as far away as ever. No Big 12 team has played for a national championship since 2009. They haven't won one since 2005. I think Texas has a chance to end that soon. I thought that they might this year, obviously. The Pac-12 is really good at creating really good individual teams, but not necessarily the depth that you need to challenge the SEC on a full conference perspective. I don't know where it's coming from, but I think it would behoove the sport. Like, it would benefit the sport if it could find some sort of foil for the number one conference in the land.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, on that, I agree. Like, I think, you know, big picture, it would be helpful. And I think this is where you see just the quality from top to bottom of the SEC is they just get so many bites at the apple year after year in the College World Series, where, you know, this year it was, you know, kind of clear, okay, if the Big 12 is going to get on this stage, it's going to have to be Texas, TCU, or maybe Texas Tech, but really mostly just Texas or TCU, then ultimately Texas only gets here. Pac-12 is a little bit of the same deal. They end up getting two teams here. You know, neither of them made a particularly deep run, so they were eliminated pretty quickly. So it's just, you know, the volume of the SEC teams ends up just being so overwhelming where it's a tough task for another conference to elbow in there. But on your point, I totally agree. Like, I just think for the help, and this, you know, by the way, I mean, this is kind of, I think this is a discussion that's being had from a football standpoint, you know, and from football, it's more like, it's less about how do we, you know, diversify and not just have it be an SEC dominated thing. And it's more like, how do we not have it be the top six teams over and over and over again?
Six, you're being generous.
I am being generous. I don't know who I'm adding in there.
Three.
But even so, like if you take, you know,
I guess four with LSU, but
yeah, or like, you know, so
maybe it's six.
I'm adding in teams like Oklahoma, for example, yeah. You know, like stuff like that. I mean, they've just been there time and time, but long story short, like this is a discussion that's being had, not just in baseball, you know, it's kind of a college sports issue that less in basketball, I suppose. But certainly in football and baseball, like I think this is a very front of mind topic.
Yeah. And, you know, unlike in those sports, you know, I don't think you're going to see a whole lot of movement to do much of anything because there's not so much that they can legislate around. You know, there's one conference that's fully invested and then there are the rest, and you're seeing the results of that. So, you know, might there be other things that other conferences could tweak? Yes. But I don't know how you top down it. I think it's got to come from within for those other places. And, you know, maybe another all SEC championship series will help be an impetus for somebody to step up and realize what they have to do, but I wouldn't bet on it. Okay. On the field, Joe, the people like picks. So how do you see this one playing out?
You know, I've ridden with Vanderbilt this whole time during the CWS, and it got a little dicey there for a little bit, and they did catch a break with NC State. I mean, maybe they would have beaten NC State straight up, but just to not have to play that second game, you know, and certainly not having gotten them full strength in that first bracket final. So can't deny that was a little bit of a break they caught. But I'm still going to ride with them. You know, they're going to have basically a fully rested Leiter to start things off. You know, that Jim Corbin expressed confidence that Rocker will be ready for game three if they need them. And as we talked about with Brad Bohannon, I mean, they do have the more vulnerability in the third game, which in this case would be a game two. So if they lose game one, if Leiter gets beat, and, you know, he did against NC State, not his fault, but, you know, they did lose a Leiter start earlier in the CWS. That's obviously a vulnerability for Vanderbilt. But like we talked about with Coach Bohannon, you know, the bullpen isn't pretty good in this CWS. Like, they've gotten good work out of guys, you know, Murphy and McElwain in particular have turned in really good outings. And so, you know, I think maybe in the grand scheme of things, sure, you know, they are a little more vulnerable versus the days that Rocker and Leiter start, but that's not to say that group can't come together and win a game in these finals. So I actually have a decent amount of confidence that, you know, they can still get it done, even if they have to lean on that unit in a third game. But at this point, you know, I don't see any reason to switch my pick. I mean, Mississippi State definitely would not shock me. They kind of have some mojo going right now. They, you know, they're kind of making things happen. We've talked about time and again this season how it's a team that just finds a way. But I think you have to look at some of the things that they'd have to have go right here. They've got Christian McLeod on the mound in game one, and his start earlier in the CWS was not particularly good. They're still kind of struggling to find a reliever other than Landon Sims they trust. Twice in the CWS, they've just kind of done like the kitchen sink thing with the bullpen. One of the games, I literally ran out of spots in my scorebook for Mississippi State relievers. So that's a little bit of a concern, but hey, they keep finding a way. And I think that's kind of what's going to make this fun, is that Mississippi State is just a tough team to beat. And so Vanderbilt's going to have to truly play well to get it done.
So I keep flipping back and forth on this. Like, initially, my feeling was Mississippi State, they just feel like they're playing so well right now. When you look at difference makers offensively, I trust Jordan and Allen more, and they're getting a lot out of, or they're not getting a lot. The depth of their lineup, though, is, you know, you see Tanner Leggett, you know, with the big hit last night, and stuff like that just keeps happening for Mississippi State. But you raise a good point about Christian McLeod. He did not look good, and he hasn't been as, like, he was better in the season than he's closing, I think is a fair assessment of the way things have gone lately for him. Bednar now won't be able to pitch until Wednesday. And then you might wonder about just how much he'll have, you know, just like you might wonder about Rocker. Mississippi State has just as much of a game three problem as Vanderbilt does, probably. Houston Harding has been pretty good in the role, but it's not like he's world beating. And now he'll likely be your game two starter unless he's needed in long relief in game one. I would expect that's how that'll go. I keep having the suspicion that Jackson Fristo is going to have to throw some innings here for Mississippi State to to win, and they just haven't gone to Frisco yet. So we'll see if that's true. And you know, if with Leiter being rested for game one, what's if it gets to a game three, you know, let's say Leiter wins one, Mississippi State wins two, and okay, now you're at game three. Well, now you have Kamar Rocker, who will be ready to go in some capacity, you know, maybe not ready to go nine, but ready to go. And his record in elimination games is absurd. So yeah, from that standpoint, you'd feel pretty good about it from Vanderbilt. But I guess for the sake of diversity on this podcast, and because I have been kind of leaning Mississippi State at times, I'll go ahead and lock in the Bulldogs as my official pick. I think that I just feel better about where their offense is at right now. And while I expect pitching to dominate the series, you can't win 0-1. So both of these teams are going to have to find ways to score some runs. And I think I just feel a little bit better about Mississippi State's ability to do that right now.
You know, for all the criticism about a lack of offense, like in baseball, particularly the major league level, at least we have negative scores. You're right. I mean, you can't win 0-1. And like, thank goodness, because in modern version of baseball, they would find a way to make that happen. It's a good point. You know, the Vanderbilt offense has underwhelmed, safe to say, so far in the CWS. They, you know, 7 runs against Arizona to start things off in a 12 inning game. So it's not even like, you know, ultimately that output, you know, on a rate basis is not going to bowl you over. They, you know, 6 runs against Stanford otherwise, you know.
To be fair, only one of those runs was extra innings.
So. Yeah, that's fair. Good point. But, you know, 6 runs against Stanford. So, you know, 6 runs in 9 inning outings and 2 of those games is the best they've done, which, I mean, that'll get it done. But those are against Arizona and Stanford's pitching staffs, you know. And even Mississippi State, for all their faults, I think we would take, you know, their pitching staff at least on par with Stanford's and certainly over Arizona. So,
I mean, I'd take them over both of those. I don't know. I don't know why you're so down on Mississippi State pitching all of a sudden.
Well, I mean, I guess I was, yeah. I mean, I guess I'm looking at like Brendan Beck and like, you know, I like Brendan Beck a lot. And so, you know, you're right. I guess I would take them over.
Sewell Bednar.
Yeah. Guy's pretty good. But the larger point I'm making is the concern about Vanderbilt's offense you have a right to be concerned about that. And that is my concern from a Vanderbilt standpoint going into the series. And the hope from Vanderbilt standpoint is that it just, as has been the case so far to get them to the finals, the hope is that it just doesn't really end up being the difference maker.
Yeah. I think this is going to be a competitive finals, no matter how we slice it. Mississippi State doesn't play non-competitive games anymore anyway. And just the way the World Series has gone so far, it's just been so evenly matched. They were relatively close games. They weren't one run games necessarily in Nashville, but they were relatively close then. So I think you're looking at what should be a very compelling final series, which would be befitting of this World Series overall. All right, Joe, let's touch briefly here on a couple of the teams that were eliminated. Texas made a really good run at this thing. They fall just short against Mississippi State, ultimately on Saturday night, getting walked off, missing a trip to the finals. The Longhorns, though, I mean, they got a lot coming back next year. We haven't actually talked about this yet, but they're going to be really highly ranked in the preseason. I mean, we'll see how the draft plays out and everything, but they're going to be ranked really highly next year and going to be expected to get back to this stage. But it's going to be a different team. Ty Madden for sure is looking like he's gone as a first round pick, and some other players will certainly depart as well. But this was, I guess, as you said last night, Joe, Texas is back.
Yeah, and that's another thing that folks can read as you listen to this. I've got a piece out on Texas, and look, it's become a meme. I get it, but from a baseball standpoint, the evidence is overwhelming. Texas is back. I mean, what they did this year, and David Pierce even said it. I was kind of glad that he said this because I think it would be easy to look at, well, they were here 2018. That wasn't that long ago. And that's true. However, very different situation. That team kind of lived a charmed life down the stretch.
Clemens did an awful lot.
Cody Clemens did a lot of heavy lifting. And then that season kind of felt like there were some holdover players, but it kind of felt like the end of a run for that team as opposed to the beginning of something. This very much feels like the beginning of something. A lot of these guys were around for a team that finished in last place in 2019. Then they dealt with the pandemic in 2020. And so it feels like a crowning achievement for this group. And they are going to lose some guys, but I think just as exciting or just as notable are the guys they're going to have back. And whether you talk about, you know, some of the freshmen they had in the lineup, you know, Faltini and Mitchell Daly and Silas Ardoin, you know, those guys, or in on the pitching staff with Tanner Witt and Aaron Nixon. Those guys are as good as just about anybody going to be coming back into college baseball next year. And so I would not be surprised at all if Texas is back here exactly a year from now, and maybe going even a little bit further. And in the big picture, it is kind of interesting that we've been writing these, as we call them, obituaries for these teams as they're eliminated. And it has struck me how much it is that the teams that we've had to write up as being eliminated, how much there is kind of a theme of, hey, this team is still pretty young. Like, there are some guys coming back. The trajectory here is good. And I understand part of that is because teams that get here tend to be also the types of teams that continue to get here. It's a pretty closed ecosystem. We just got done talking about that to some degree. However, I don't think it's just that. I do think these are also just happen to be a group of teams that are all kind of cresting at the same time, whether you're talking about Arizona, Stanford, Tennessee, Virginia to some degree, certainly Texas, maybe best among that group. It's a really exciting group of teams that have been eliminated here. And so while they are all disappointed, maybe Texas the most because they were so close, those teams all have a lot to be excited about moving forward.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Really, one of the few teams that maybe doesn't feel that way is Tennessee. Just there's going to be a lot of turnover in Knoxville, I think, but you know, still to just have gotten to this point after 16 years of not being in Omaha, and just how much that program has grown, you still just feel good about the momentum from this year, even if next year they have to reset a little bit, or if the team is just going to look a little different. It has been, you know, and Virginia in some way to a similar way. You can point to a few pieces of Virginia and be very excited about what they have coming back next year. But again, just after a few difficult seasons to get back to this stage, it was very impressive. So of any of those other teams outside of the last four, who among the first four eliminated, I guess, Joe, made something of an impression on you this week?
I think I'm interested in what Stanford has. They're one of the first four, right? That is correct.
Yes.
Hard to keep up with, like, with the order
Stanford,
of operations.
Stanford, Arizona,
here.
Tennessee, and I just lost the last one.
That would be Virginia, right?
Virginia, yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, Virginia, too, like, they're kind of on the cusp of, like, they do have some guys who are leaving, but it's like, if you really believe in the young talent there, what, you know, Kyle Teal and Chris Newell and Nate Savino, like, that's kind of what they have going for them there. But I'd probably say Stanford because it just, they are really well positioned, I feel like, with their young position player group. Also, you know, some of their younger players felt like the more talented players. They got some good years from older players. Tim Tawa is an example. Nick Bruiser is another example. Brendan Beck, of course. But it felt like perhaps the more talented guys they have are their younger guys. I mean, Brock Jones will be back for one more go around, and Drew Bowser, a big year debuting in the Pac-12. And so that more than I think the others feels like a program that has maybe turned a little bit of a corner. I would probably feel the same about Arizona. However, maybe as a segue into a little bit of a different topic, they have some uncertainty because, yes, they do have young players returning, but now they're going through a coaching change. There's also uncertainty about, with the new coach trying to get hired right before the transfer portal deadline, do they hold those young players in Tucson? There's a lot of questions there for Arizona. I love the talent they have in Tucson as long as it sticks around, but that really is the big question.
Yeah, I think Arizona probably is the would have been the answer if things didn't break the way they broke later this week. We'll touch on Arizona here in a second. I like what Virginia has. I mean, like everything you said about Stanford is true. I'm very excited to see Brock Jones next year and how, if he made this kind of jump this year, like, is there more development left? Even if there's not, like, I just love watching that guy play. And then Tennessee, like I said, gotta feel great about the trajectory of the program and the fact that Tony Vitello is back next year, that he didn't get hired for any of these jobs that kept getting talked about. You know, now where do you go as you continue to build that program? What's the next step? And very interested to see that. But yeah, Arizona has as much young talent as anyone. They had two true freshmen make the All-America team and Jacob Berry and Daniel Susak. They have a young core in the pitching staff. They have a lot of talent coming back. However, Jay Johnson was hired as LSU's next head coach. He'll be introduced tomorrow. Well, I guess as we record this, he'll be listening to this tomorrow. If you're listening to this on Monday, he's being introduced to Baton Rouge today. And pitching coach Nate Yeske was hired away by Jim Schlossnagel at Texas A&M to be his pitching coach. So those two guys are gone. And now Arizona's left, starting over from a coaching staff standpoint. And like you said, now the first responsibility, I guess, is potentially going to be re-recruiting the roster. And that's it's a really talented roster. Got some good recruits coming in. Again, got to potentially re-recruit them. But at least they were interested in Arizona before. So everything's set up pretty well there. But there is now a lot of uncertainty. From an LSU standpoint, Joe, I mean, to hire Jay, they are, according to my research, Jay Johnson will be the first head baseball coach to go from the Pac-12 to the SEC directly. It's never happened before. There's a lot of consternation out there about, like, well, how's he going to do? Like, West Coast guy coming to the Southeast, how's he going to do? And pressure cooker environment that is Baton Rouge. And there's so much more attention here and so much more media coverage. And how's he going to handle all of that? And all of that, I say, he'll be just fine, guys. He's one of the best recruiters in the country. He is like a guy that actually goes out and recruits as a head coach. And that can be a difference maker, because in a sport where you only have two assistant coaches, only your head coaches and those two assistant coaches are allowed to go out and recruit. If you have a head coach who is dogged on the recruiting trail, like that's a big thing. I mean, and I think that's a big reason why he has been able to bring in such good recruiting classes to Arizona. All five of his classes at Arizona have been ranked previously. In the previous 15 years of the Baseball America recruiting rankings, Arizona had just four ranked recruiting classes. He landed a number one ranked recruiting class at San Diego. And that wasn't the Chris Bryant class. He also brought Chris Bryant to San Diego. So, like, I feel like he's going to do fine, because so much about having success in this sport, at least right now, is about going out and finding the right players. And that is one of the absolute best qualities of Jay Johnson as a coach. He's a really good hitting coach too. There's a reason why Arizona had the best offense in the country this year. So if you're bringing those two things to the table, like I just feel really good about everything else, how everything else will fall into place. He's going to have to hire a good pitching coach. Like, that's absolutely true, but it's LSU. Like, the resources are there to do that. The program, the brand, it's all there to do that. So I feel really good about the future of LSU and Jay Johnson's ability to have success there.
And the recruiting head coach part is a good point, because it's almost like having a bonus coach in some ways, you know, where he can be so involved on the recruiting side while also doing the head coach piece of it. And, oh, by the way, you mentioned, you know, being a really good hitting coach. You know, I saw LSU, you know, up close in Knoxville a couple of weeks ago, and I wrote in the immediate aftermath of that, of whoever the next coach is, which you now know is Jay Johnson, that coach is going to have a really good lineup on its hands. There are questions to be asked on the pitching side, you know, with Marceau and Jaden Hill leaving, a couple of older relievers also, but the lineup is really, really good. And the lineup was pretty young this year in a lot of places. And so I'm really excited to see what Jay Johnson can do with those guys, because I think that's going to be not a lot of fun for SEC pitching coaches to have to game plan for next year. A Jay Johnson led LSU lineup with those young players they had this year, like, woof, that's going to be a tough assignment. But I'm with you in that, look, I think fit matters. I'm someone who believes that fit matters, but I think it only matters to an extent, right? I think if you're a good coach and you're willing to throw yourself into a job and really throw yourself into the community and the culture and everything that goes into winning there, I think just about anybody who's willing to do that can win just about anywhere. There are some exceptions. There are sometimes, by the way, where you know, things just don't work out for like no good reason, bad luck and all kinds of things get cooked into it. That happens all the time. And so I'm also not ruling that out, but I'm not as skittish as some are on the fit. But LSU is also a unique animal, right? I mean, there's no job like it in college baseball. And while I have confidence in Jay's ability to handle it, he's also a, you know, kind of a gregarious guy. He, you know, doesn't mind the media part of it. Or at least hasn't to this point. Again, LSU is a step above in a lot of ways from what people are used to from a media standpoint, but you know, he doesn't mind that part of it. I know you and I have both had good interactions with him in that regard. So there's that. So, you know, I understand why people might kind of cock their head a little bit at this. But like I said, I think good coaches who are willing to put in that kind of work more often than not are going to get it figured out. Understanding also that sometimes things just don't work out and LSU is just a pressure cooker of a job, you know? And so if things get sideways, they can really get sideways quick at a place like LSU. And that's certainly the challenge and the risk that Jay's taken on here.
I mean, I just feel like this is also one of those jobs that is really set up for you to win and win big. And if you're pretty good at your job, you're probably going to be able to take advantage of that. And again, I think Jay is more than pretty good at his job. So fit matters, but I don't know how much it matters. You know, like it definitely matters to an extent, but the way it matters is a way in which we on the outside are always going to struggle to evaluate. It's something you can at least predict. You might be able to evaluate it afterwards and figure out why it didn't work, but predicting it going in, I just don't think we have a very good handle on that. And you just have to be inside the building to know how some of this stuff works, to know who's too involved, who's not involved enough, and you know, which parties you have to keep happy and all the rest of that. And you know, if we knew all of that, we'd you know, the college sports just doesn't allow for you to know all of those things. And that's why you see all the time, you know, fit coaches not working out at places that people are convinced that they will. So, you know, we'll see how this one goes. Obviously, it's going to be an interesting thing now with Jay Johnson and Jim Schlossnagle both joining the SEC West. Things just got harder there. Or stayed as hard. I don't know. It's like Brad Bohannon said, it's the toughest division in amateur sports. And I'm not really here to argue that. Like in college baseball, at least this is the premier place. And, you know, so it'll be a lot of fun to watch as a neutral observer next season and well into the future, I think. All right. So that's going to do it for us today on the Baseball America College Podcast. The next time we come at you with a podcast, we'll have a national champion. How about that? So you can subscribe to the Baseball America Podcast on your favorite podcasting app, be that Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you look for your podcasts, you can find us. And we'll have a wrap up coming at you later in the week of the National Championship Series. And then throughout the offseason, we'll take you through likely with more interviews like you heard today. We love bringing on our guests and so if you have anyone that you would like to hear from this offseason, let us know either in a comment there on Apple Podcasts or on Twitter. You can find me at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy BA. And check out everything over at baseballamerica.com. Joe referenced several of his stories. There's a lot to read right now over there. And there will be a lot to read throughout the week as we get ever closer to crowning a national champion in college baseball. So for Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next time on the Baseball America College Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.